You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I'm Belle Sawhill, and along with Ron Haskins, I've been very interested in these fiscal issues for quite a long time. And we have been meeting with a group of budget experts that we call the Fiscal Seminar, co-sponsored by Brookings and Heritage, for a number of years. And we have just produced this paper on premium support. Two of the authors of that paper are here on the panel. One is in favor of premium support, and that's Jim Capretta. And the other is not in favor, and that's Henry Aaron. And they, along with four others, are going to discuss the pros and the cons of premium support. The Fiscal Seminar paper, by the way, does include a nice description of the Domenici-Rivlin plan. So that is the version of premium support that we are discussing here. I think one point we all would want to make or emphasize is that premium support can be many different things. The devil is often in the details. And so it's good to have a specific proposal to discuss. And I find it very interesting that Ryan Wyden is so similar to Rivlin and Domenici. And so you can consider this as a discussion of both, if you like, to some extent. I mean, there may be some details we don't quite understand yet. Now, in addition to Jim Capretta and Henry Aaron, we have Judy Fader from the Georgetown Public Policy Institute. We have Paul Vandewater from the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. We have Stuart Butler from Heritage. And we have Doug Holtz-Aiken from the American Action Forum. I am not going to talk about their bios. You can read them. I think if you do, you will be impressed with the extent of expertise on healthcare policy that we have assembled here this morning. I'm a little bit intimidated myself. But with that, let me start with Judy Fader to make some brief comments on premium support.
Thank you, Belle, and no reason to be intimidated. You always hold your own. No problem there. It's good to be with you all this morning. I want to start with what Senator Domenici said in talking about the proposal. As a supporter for premium support, he recognizes that he and other supporters are asking us to replace a long-standing public insurance program through Medicare with vouchers for private insurance and Medicare, something, as he emphasized, that is really new and untried. And you'd think, given that he and others are asking for such a change, that an argument would be based on evidence that private insurers and competition among them had successfully guaranteed equitable access to affordable care. While, on the other hand, that Medicare program's just done a lousy job. Funny, the evidence shows us exactly the opposite. Now, I'm not saying that Medicare is perfect. Its record is far, far from what it could be. But its payment mechanisms, like those for all of healthcare, need reform. But relative to private insurance, which is the alternative being proposed, Medicare's performance is extraordinarily impressive. First, and perhaps foremost, Medicare does a terrific job at what any successful insurance plan has to do. It pools risk without regard to health status, bringing together lots of people when they're healthy to pay for care when any of us or any of them, although it will soon be us, become sick. It's a large risk pool. Competing private insurers, in contrast, profit, just like their shareholders want them to do, by focusing on and serving the healthy and avoiding the sick. With competition among private insurance plans, it takes aggressive government intervention and oversight to assure that doesn't happen. And that's what the exchange is supposed to do. That's what Diana Meredith was talking about when she went and she and Alice talked about risk adjustment. It's making sure that there's not discrimination against us when we're sick and preference for the healthy. The whole market works against that, and as I said, it requires very aggressive oversight, the kind of aggressive regulation that Senator Domenici minimized that's necessary to make this work. So it's a real issue of government enforcement. It's not something you can lightly pass over, and I think Paul Vanderwater is going to say more about how challenging that task is in a minute. But to get back to my comparison, in Medicare, because it is one single risk pool for the most part, except for the private plans in Medicare now, one single risk pool, that risk pooling just comes naturally. Don't need a lot of management to make it happen. Now, having tens of millions of people in a single pool also gives Medicare an edge in dealing with providers who are increasingly concentrated and therefore increasingly effective in driving up payments where they can. Medicare pays hospitals about 30% less than private insurers do and pays physicians about 20% less. In overwhelming numbers, however, providers accept what Medicare pays. Why? Because they can't live without Medicare's business. But that's not true for private insurers, who increasingly confront providers with close to monopoly power, whether because insurers who don't have a lot of market share lack the clout, or in some cases, because they lack the market pressure, private insurers have been markedly ineffective in resisting private pressure to increase premium payments. If your goal is cost containment or value for the dollar, which it clearly is, why'd you give up Medicare's considerable purchasing advantage? Divvy it up among multiple players beats the hell out of me. Now, Medicare's greater success in controlling costs is not just in the level of spending, but also in rates of growth. Historically, Medicare per capita spending has grown a bit slower than the private sector's. But when Medicare is serious about containing costs, as is demonstrated by the Affordable Care Act, the difference really shows. CBO finds that Medicare premiums currently estimated to be 11% below the private insurance premiums for the same benefit package will be about 30% lower by the end of the decade. Now, let me take this to the end of the next decade. Let me take this growth rate apart a little bit so we can understand what's going on. It's important to remember that Medicare cost growth reflects two components, growth in costs per capita and growth in the number of capitas or enrollees. Looking out over the next 10 years, the combination of the two, per capita cost times cost per capitas, per capita cost times number of capitas, leads to an overall aggregate growth rate of 6.7%. And it was the aggregate growth rate that was on the chart that you all were talking about. That's the number that critics of Medicare focus on and raising concern, and it is a concern. But it's actually the growth in the capitas that has come to drive costs faster than GDP. And that's because, not surprisingly, we baby boomers are joining the program and will continue to do so at a rate of about 1.5 million a year. When it comes to what healthcare costs per person, Medicare's growth rate is remarkably low. As a result of the payment changes in the Affordable Care Act, Medicare per capita spending is projected to grow at an average rate of about 3% a year, as much as a point below the growth in GDP per capita, and even lower at about the same as growth in GDP per capita if we fix the physician payment formula, the SGR. So my thought is I really don't know why we don't declare victory and just keep at it. Taking $500 billion out of the Medicare program, as we did in the Affordable Care Act, without endangering access, makes a pretty big dent. Now, not only is the growth rate that we're now projected to achieve below the Rivlin-Domenici target of GDP plus one, it's also enforceable, which Alice talked about. The Affordable Care Act does set up a mechanism to divorce growth rates, enforce growth rates. If Medicare spending growth exceeds GDP plus one per beneficiary, the Affordable Care Act's Independent Payment Advisory Board is charged with proposing changes to lower the growth rate, which are then fast-tracked through the Congress. But the fact is that the cost reductions the ACA has already put in place slow spending so much that CBO finds it unlikely that this board will even be activated in the coming decade. Why then is this argument to shift strong from a strong public insurer to vouchers for private insurance on the table? Well, I think there are a lot of reasons, not the least of which is ideology. And despite the fact that its staunchest advocates are now walking away, I heard Congressman Ryan yesterday, from cost-saving money being the primary goal, I suspect it's because we'd like more cost containment than we already have, which you pretty much said. Vouchers that take apart the strongest means we've got to that mechanism are not the way. It's not that we should abandon public or weaken public insurance that is demonstrably superior to the alternative that's being proposed. Undermining Medicare's risk pooling and its market power, its equity and efficiency in one fell swoop. It's to make that public health insurance work better and to extend the improvements in payment and delivery reform that its market power make possible to the whole healthcare system. That's what the changes in the Affordable Care Act were all about, and that's the path that will allow efficiency, equity, and affordable health care in the future. Thanks.
Thank you, Judy, and thank you for staying within your time limit.
Close.
So the next up is Jim Capretta. I neglected to say where you were from earlier, Jim. I said you were an author. Jim is a fellow with the Ethics and Public Policy Center and a member of the Fiscal Seminar.
Thank you, Belle. Pleased to be here this morning. I think you might not be surprised to see that I might be on a parallel universe with Judy. So. I read an interview with the just recently departed CMS administrator where he made the statement just the other day that, the problem in our healthcare system is the healthcare delivery system. It's not with Medicare. It's essentially what he said, or Medicaid. And I'm here to argue, I think, that he's got basically it wrong, right? It's a proposition I think he's actually really wrong about, which is that is the healthcare delivery system problem totally unrelated to the way Medicare is currently structured? And I think the evidence shows that it absolutely is related to the way Medicare is currently structured. Medicare, as Judy indicated, is the dominant payer in most marketplaces. We have a problem in American healthcare that is essentially related to is been analyzed every which way of fragmentation, inefficiency, lack of coordination, too often very poor care, duplicative tests and procedures, overuse of procedures, and so on. What is the primary driving force behind that? It's Medicare fee-for-service. 90% of the participants in the Medicare fee-for-service program have supplemental insurance. Which means that at the point of service, they actually pay nothing. Yes, Medicare has quite a bit of cost sharing associated with it, but for the vast, vast majority of participants in the program, at the actual point of service, there is no cost to the beneficiary. So there's a tremendous volume incentive in the Medicare fee-for-service world that is driving very substantially the inefficiency that exists in healthcare delivery. So to argue that the healthcare delivery system is totally unrelated to Medicare, I think it's just plain wrong. The second point I want to make is we have a key question we need to ask, which is which process will bring about higher quality and higher productivity in that delivery system? That's the question we're trying to address. How are we going to bring that about? Because if you don't bring about higher productivity and higher quality, any effort you do, including many of the things that Judy referred to, across-the-board cost-cutting in Medicare, actually result in erosion in quality, not an improvement in quality. The only way to make the system less expensive without eroding quality is to make it more productive. And how can you do that? Now, one answer, the one I think Judy's trying to promote and Dr. Berwick tried to promote in this article, was that actually government can make that happen somehow through accountable care organizations, bundled payments, innovation, the innovation center ideas that are coming forward. I'm here to tell you that I think that's going to fail. The government, this is not a new idea. The government has been trying to push through the Medicare program to get to a higher value, lower cost delivery structure through the Medicare program for 30 years. It's not a new idea, and it hasn't gone very well. Now, why hasn't it gone very well? A good example might be what they tried in the 1990s, called the Centers of Excellence demonstration, where the HICFA, then HICFA, was going to go out and figure out which hospitals were centers of excellence, designate them as such, and then, you know, put their toe in the water and start steering the beneficiaries in the Medicare program to those hospitals as opposed to the other non-centers of excellence. The first announcement went out designating the hospitals. All the ones who aren't on the list said, hey, what's up? You know, how come we're not a center of excellence? They said the data was lousy. They went to the Hill, and they killed the idea. This has been repeated over and over and over again in the Medicare program. It's what I would call the Lake Wobegon effect. Okay, basically, every provider in the Medicare program is slightly above average, and they always pay everybody basically the same. They have an incapacity to put low-value providers out of the program. To get delivery system reform, to get higher productivity and higher value, you got to get the low-value people out, and Medicare just can't do that. Now, the question is, can a competitive private delivery structure driven by premium support bring about a better outcome? I think the answer and the evidence is pointing in the direction of yes. Do we have a randomized trial that we can experiment? You know, we have a study that we can run for 10 years and figure this out? No. You're going to have to look at the evidence that's available and make some judgments. First piece of evidence, of course, is we have a Part D program that is essentially premium support for drugs. What's happened in the Part D program? The premium in 2012 is going to be $30 on average across the plans for the beneficiary. In 2006, after 6 years of experience, in 2006 it was $26. Okay, there was an amendment offered when the thing was being considered, trying to make sure that the beneficiary paid no less and no more than $35. If that amendment had passed, they'd probably be paying more. Okay. The program has actually worked pretty well. Lots of predictions that it would never work, that private insurers would never participate, that it would be too confusing, nobody could move from high premium plans to low premium plans. All that has been proven wrong. There has been migration from high premium to low premium plans. That's why the premiums have held relatively steadily. Some people have argued, well, this is a national trend. It's happened throughout the whole health prescription drug program. It's true that nationwide drugs have come down, but they haven't come down as much as they have in Part D. On average across the country, it's been about 27%. In Part D, it's been about 40% compared to 2004 projections. Generic substitution has moved up faster for the elderly than it has for the non-elderly. So there's been an effect of the Part D program, competition, moving people into lower cost options. It's worked. People actually want to pay lower premiums, and if you give them an option that's reasonable, they'll sign up for it. I was told the other night, I can't verify this, I haven't had a chance to verify it, but Stanford University has essentially a premium support program for their current employees. They now have 70%, apparently, people in Kaiser Permanente, which is the low-cost option in Northern California. That's delivery system reform. You know, if you're going to have changes on the ground in how medical care is actually delivered to patients, you're going to have more people signing up for organized, integrated systems that are the low-cost option. Kaiser does it quite well. They've run it in California for a long time. And on the ground, when you give people the choice and you make them pay the premium, the evidence is showing they actually sign up for it more than they would have otherwise. Now, there's going to be some judgment involved in this. Do we believe that the government can manufacture a higher value, more efficient healthcare delivery system? Or do we think some level of competition and incentives will bring it about? That's fundamentally the question. And I think the evidence is overwhelming that the government has been trying unsuccessfully to do it, and now people are saying, well, give it one more try for the next decade. We've got this demo. We've got this innovation center. It's very, very likely to end up, as all the others have, with the Lake Wobegon effect, with all the doctors still in the network, all the hospitals still in the network, and all of them essentially paid the same. You can't bring about delivery system reform by doing that. So we need to move in a system where consumers make more choices, they can drive efficiency in the system, and the low-value people actually get kicked out through the private sector. I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Paul Vanderwater.
Thanks, Bill. If premium support is to have any chance of working, health insurers must be pressed to compete on the basis of providing value for money rather than attracting healthy enrollees and deterring sicker ones. The Rivlin Domenici plan makes a number of steps in that direction, but still falls short in critical areas. First is low-income protection. The proposal says that current Medicare beneficiaries with low incomes will be guaranteed access to traditional Medicare with no additional premiums. That's fine as far as it goes, but it doesn't apply to new beneficiaries. And it doesn't apply to anyone whose income is greater than 135% of the federal poverty threshold. Thus, elderly or disabled individuals with incomes as low as $15,000 or couples with incomes as low as $20,000 could face higher premiums. Second is the scope of benefits. Today, Medicare Advantage plans can reduce the scope of some benefits if they increase others or reduce certain cost sharing, as long as they provide the same actuarial value as traditional Medicare. The Wyden-Ryan proposal explicitly adopts an even weaker actuarial value standard. And from what Alice said earlier, the Rivlin-Domenici plan appears to do so as well. And even if a plan nominally covered the same services as traditional Medicare, it could still fall short in terms of the adequacy of its network, waiting times, customer service, or other features. Now, although it might be possible in theory to add elements to a premium support plan to make it seem acceptable on paper, these additional elements are, as a practical matter, impossible to enact or implement in the current political climate. Proponents of premium support acknowledge that risk adjustment is critical to its success, but there's good evidence that current risk adjustment technology is inadequate to the task. And moreover, insurance companies are trying to withhold data necessary to assure that risk adjustment under the Affordable Care Act is allowed to meet its potential. Further, any premium support system should discourage risk selection by standardizing insurance offerings. The Affordable Care Act requires that plans offered through the health exchanges provide an essential health benefits package and empowers the federal government to define its components. But here, too, insurers are trying to undercut the law by proposing that the essential health benefits package be defined in terms of a dollar value rather than a specific set of covered services. In this way, both the Rivlin-Domenici and Wyden-Ryan proposals would allow insurers to continue to engage in cream skimming through plan design. To compete with private plans on a comparable basis, traditional Medicare would need authority to offer an integrated benefit package, including drug and supplemental coverage, to update that package in response to changes in the health care system and insurance markets, and possibly to offer various benefit options, such as preferred provider organizations. Congress is unlikely to provide that authority in light of the opposition which we saw to including a strong public option in health reform. Even if a premium support plan included the necessary consumer protections, monitoring and enforcement of those protections would be difficult. State insurance regulators complain that the federal government does not now adequately protect consumers from deceptive practices by private Medicare plans. They've sought authority to enforce state laws on marketing practices, but insurers have succeeded in blocking this proposal and will likely continue to do so. Traditional Medicare is a popular program for the reasons that Judy Fader has explained. The program has a strong record of innovation and cost control. Before substantially restructuring it, we need to be confident that the new arrangements will be allowed to work even better. This is particularly important since Medicare beneficiaries face many more challenges than those of working age in dealing with a competitive choice-based system. Many have physical or cognitive impairments that make it difficult or impossible for them to assess alternative packages or to cope with limited provider networks or other restrictions. For this group, a poorly implemented premium support plan would impose particularly high costs. Only when the Affordable Care Act exchanges have been up and running effectively should we consider introducing a similar arrangement in Medicare. Judy Fader, Henry Aaron, and I share the concern that Senator Domenici and Alice Rivlin have with constraining cost growth in Medicare, but we have a different vision of how best to achieve that goal. The Affordable Care Act takes important steps to slow the growth of health care costs, as Judy has said, through host delivery system reforms. And as a backstop, it creates an independent payment advisory board that will make sure that spending growth per beneficiary is limited to the growth of GDP per capita plus one percentage point, the very same growth rate target promised by the Rivlin-Domenici and Wyden-Ryan plans. And unlike premium support, it does so without reducing benefits or potentially shifting costs to beneficiaries. We shouldn't abandon that approach before giving it every chance to work. Now, in my last couple minutes, I'd just like to say a few words about the points that Jim Capretta has made with regard to delivery system reform. First, we have to remember that despite the acknowledged political impediments which Jim has cited, nevertheless, citing Judy's figures, Medicare has still had a better cost control record than the private sector. So that's important to keep in mind. Secondly, with the Affordable Care Act, we do have an important new institution, the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which is an effort to try to get around some of the political roadblocks which have heretofore been in the way of Medicare being able to do an even better job. And the Congressional Budget Office said last year, CBO's Director Elmendorf, that the Independent Payment Advisory Board, along with the tax on high-cost health insurance plans in the ACA, represent two of the most important new cost control mechanisms that the ACA puts in place. As far as the innovative record of private plans is concerned, that leaves a lot to be desired. I think Senator Domenici mentioned the record of the Federal Employee Health Benefits Plan, but as a federal retiree and participant in one of the largest plans within FEHB, I can speak from experience that despite significant amounts of cost sharing or skin in the game, as the proponents of premium support like to call it, plan still does remarkably little to hold down the growth of costs and press us a little in the way of care coordination. So I think that to reiterate what Judy has said, if one looks at the record, Medicare heretofore has done very well compared to private plans, and we should be very cautious before we risk traditional Medicare for a new untried scheme.
Thank you, Paul. And next will be Stuart Butler.
Thank you very much. As Ron Haskins kind of explained in his introduction to the publication that you have, the idea of premium support has a very, very long history and a bipartisan history. Henry Aaron, of course, with Robert Reichshire, coined the term. And back in the 1990s, there was considerable discussion of it. We had a bipartisan commission centered on that idea. More recently, of course, we've had other proposals such as the Domenici Rivlin plan, and now more recently this plan. The Heritage Foundation for many years has supported that, and you have a publication along those lines. So it's something that has been developing and being refined constantly over many, many years. And I think when you look at it, you see the themes becoming clearer, and I think the range of debate and the engineering aspects are getting clearer and sort of narrower in the sense of being a greater consensus. That said, I think the concerns that are raised and are raised in Henry's paper, for example, and have been raised generally over that whole period have a validity to them. They are concerns that have to be constantly addressed. And I think we are engaged in what I would call an engineering discussion about precisely how to do that and how to improve them. So I see this as very much an iterative process of a basic design and a basic idea. When you look at the themes of premium support, I think there are a number of them that are very clear and evident, and I think then lead to further discussions about how best to structure them. One, which is not unique to this, is the idea of a long-term budget for Medicare, some longer-term cap or a determined amount that should be spent on the Medicare program. That's critical today because of our budget situation. I think it's also critical in terms of seeing Medicare alongside other national goals that have to be discussed and debated, and that money debated accordingly and distributed accordingly. I think that's one of the key features of premium support, but I said is not unique to premium support. The second theme, which flows from the first, is that the device used to maintain a reasonable budget over time on the premium support is to provide an adequate level of support, of finance, to individuals to be able to obtain an adequate level of services. Now, we can debate exactly how that should be, but that's a basic theme, as opposed to methods, say, in the United Kingdom, where I come from originally, or Canada, which says, let's give certain amounts of money to providers or to institutions or to regional health authorities and let them distribute it. So there's a strong theme of putting control and choice into the hands of individuals as opposed to going through area authorities or something like that. A third element, which is critically important, is that thinking about where to set this amount of support as a baseline or benchmark, I think increasingly people who share the view of premium support recognize that it's got to be connected to actual costs of healthcare. And in the Domenici Rivlin plan and others in the Heritage plan, we look at some kind of competitive bidding process to say the amount of money you get really does have to be tied to actual cost. Now, should it be the lowest cost plan or the second lowest, as in Domenici Rivlin, or some market basket of below average, below median plans? That's up to conversation and debate. And you see that in the different plans. But linking it in that way is very important for the benchmark. Then as you think about over time, you have the issue of how rapidly do you allow any budget to grow? And that's another central theme and central discussion. What should the indexing be of any kind of plan? Well, it seems to me when you look at what is the objective of indexing the rate of growth, you're really trying to balance three goals or considerations. You're trying to reach a budget objective, which in these days, with our concern about debt and the economy, is a really important objective. You're trying to do that. At the same time, you're trying to bring about a reasonable balance of financial risk between beneficiaries, between taxpayers today, between them and beneficiaries and taxpayers in the future, the debt and so forth. You're trying to juggle these different goals for the index simultaneously. And within the beneficiary risk, financial risk, you're also looking at low-income and high-income people. And that's why you see income adjustments built in to good premium support systems in terms of making sure that the people at the low end are as insulated as best you can from financial risk. But maybe people, Warren Buffett, maybe should shoulder a little bit more risk than somebody else. So I think that's a very, very important theme. And I do agree very strongly with Henry and others that when you look at an indexing system, you've got to relate it in some way to the cost of healthcare. That's why I favor looking at actually an inflation CPI plus one-based system as opposed to a growth in the economy system. But this can be debated. Both are intended to try to get the right balance within these goals. I think so the indexing is really important. Fifth, I think it's very important, and you see this again in this debate about when does something like this click in. I don't think we should exempt baby boomers from having to shoulder some of the risk and some of the cost about meeting these goals. I think because, you know, Bill Gates happens to be, I think, 57 years old, I don't think he should be removed from having to have some skin in the game in terms of carrying the financial risk as a baby boomer. So that's why I and others, I think, who support some features of premium support, argue for it coming in much more quickly for those individuals. Politically, that's difficult, no question about it. But I think in terms of what is a right and fair way of doing it makes a lot more sense. The sixth theme, I think, which is important, which you're seeing increasingly discussed in premium support, is that, yes, there does have to be an infrastructure of information, of appropriate consumer protection, and exactly how you do it can be debated. We can build on existing structures in the Medicare program. We can create an exchange system, as Rivlin Domenici does. Some version of this has to be in this system. I don't disagree with that at all. I think that's an essential element of thoughtful premium support systems. And then I think also, and this is sort of just a return to a point that's been made a lot of times, I think that in terms of thinking about fee-for-service, fee-for-service, in my view, and I think the view of most people who support premium support, should neither be artificially protected nor should it be artificially closed down. What we should do is look at the fee-for-service system and structure it so that it can be seen as essentially an open network system with a premium associated with that, and that premium is subjected, so to speak, to the premium support system itself. So it's not that you say we've got to phase out fee-for-service. We say it's got to be structured with a premium and with appropriate risk adjustment so that it actually does compete. And if Judy Fader is correct, and it is really the most efficient method of dealing with healthcare that God has ever imagined, then ultimately it will prevail in that competition. But it's got to be on an even basis. So I think in conclusion, when you look at premium support, as I said, it's got a long history. I think its themes are clear. Its objectives are clear. But it's recognized that it's a constant iterative process of refinement and engineering to deal with the very legitimate issues that come up. This is not unique to this particular way of dealing with the problem. It's got to be refined and so on. And I think the most recent iteration, the Wyden-Ryan bill, is an excellent example of another stage in this process. I think it deals with a lot of the issues that were raised. It doesn't deal with them all. But I think it is another step forward in the way that we have to go to deal with the budget problem and also getting an affordable, acceptable level of health care for seniors and one that's also affordable for future taxpayers and future seniors and our children and grandchildren. Thank you.
If you're noticing a pattern here, that first we have one person who is in favor of premium or is against premium support, and then someone who's in favor of it, you're on your toes this morning. And so in the last set of pairs here, pro and con, I'm going to call on Henry Aaron, my colleague here at Brookings, who is another author of one of these papers that we're releasing today, and then finally to Doug Holtz-Aiken. But Henry first.
Thank you very much. My text for today is a remark attributed to John Maynard Keynes. When the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? In 1995, when Bob Reichauer and I coined the term premium support and described its characteristics, the environment for health policy was rather different from what it is today. The Clinton health plan had failed. Hope for systemic health care reform was dead. Medicare spending per person was rising faster than other health care spending. And several groups had endorsed or come close to endorsing replacing Medicare with vouchers that people could use to buy private insurance. We thought that simply dropping money on the Medicare population and asking them to fend for themselves in the famously dysfunctional small group insurance market was a recipe for disaster. So we put forward three conditions for such a shift. The voucher should be linked to an index that grows as fast as overall per-person healthcare spending. Insurance offerings and selling arrangements should be aggressively regulated, and risk adjustment had to be good enough to make cream skimming by insurance companies unprofitable. The linkage to health cost index was critical. Savings had to come from genuine efficiencies, not from offloading costs onto the elderly and the disabled. Aggressive regulation was essential because insurers have the bad habit of overloading customers with so many plan variations that nobody can possibly choose rationally among them. Furthermore, plan offerings and sales methods can subtly, or not so subtly, abet competition based on risk selection. For example, we offer sports medicine benefits. Hear about our plan after the dance. It starts at 8, ends at 11. The venue is on the second floor. Sorry, no elevator. And risk adjustment had to be good enough so that insurers could make money only by competing on what counts: better service and higher quality of care. Well, 16 years have gone by since Bob and I wrote, and some things have changed. Some others haven't. The most important change is basic health care policy. But we've also gained a deeper understanding of what we don't know how to do, and we've learned the limits of what elected officials are willing to do. On policy, first, Medicare has changed. Most notably, for purposes of today's discussion, the sort of competitive system that voucher advocates say they want to create already exists. The average Medicare enrollee today may choose among an average of 24 plans, in addition to traditional Medicare, including an average of 10 health maintenance organizations. Furthermore, Medicare spending per person is slated, at least for the next decade and under current law, to rise less than the targets set under the Domenici-Rivlin and Wyden-Ryan plans. Second, and most important, systemic health care reform is no longer a pipe dream. It is the law of the land. The Affordable Care Act sets in motion a process of experimentation and change, long overdue, but with the potential to revolutionize how the United States pays for and delivers health care. Not every element of that plan is going to succeed, but some are likely to do so. We're going to try ACOs, accountable care organizations, bundled payments, comparative effectiveness research, a center for innovation, to name just a few, an independent payment advisory board. It is also going to lower reimbursement directly by curbing Medicare spending by roughly $500 billion over the next decade. To be sure, implementation of the Affordable Care Act is going to be hard. States are now discovering that the prospect of enrolling 29 million people in health insurance exchanges and avoiding competition based on risk selection won't be easy. They're working on those problems, and I think they can solve them. But dealing with nearly 50 million Medicare enrollees would be vastly harder. Why? Because per-person spending under Medicare is three times that on those who will be served under the Affordable Care Act, and the variation in spending is correspondingly larger. So, therefore, is the profit from cream skimming. Furthermore, as noted, many Medicare beneficiaries are people with mental disabilities and early or advanced mental decline. The recently announced Wyden-Ryan plan promises to provide voucher recipients with, and I quote, clear and easy to understand information, close quote, on various plans. Now, those of you who are old enough, I ask you, have any of you actually read the clear and easy to understand information that Medicare and private insurers now distribute to enrollees? If you have, then I think you'll agree that to think that providing such clear and easy to understand information equips those with mental disabilities or even early state dementia the capacity to deal with competing insurance plans is simply delusional. So what is the takeaway? Well, first, contrary to the allegations of critics, Medicare works. It provides benefits fairly and at lower overall cost than typical private insurance plans do. Second, the so-called premium support plans put forward so far are not very well designed. They lack the regulatory teeth necessary to make premium support even worth considering. And I've lost my page here.
You take one of mine.
No. Well, I haven't sunk that low. Third, even well-designed premium support plans are not, I've said that, are not ready for prime time. We have work to do in implementing the Affordable Care Act. When that work is done, then we will be able to decide whether it makes sense to extend similar arrangements to Medicare recipients. And fourth, there are important changes to be made in Medicare that will improve its operation. Among those changes would be to give the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services the administrative resources they need to reduce improper payments and to enforce coverage guidelines. Reform of supplementary insurance is long overdue, and the Congressional Budget Office options book contains a long list of modifications to Medicare, many of which were endorsed by the Rivlin-Domenici plan, that also should be enacted. Finally, controlling overall health care costs is genuinely, as Alice said, urgently important. The need to lick that problem is why the nation's top health priority now is to implement the Affordable Care Act, not to replace Medicare, a well-functioning and popular program, with an untried alternative distressingly similar to private plans that so far do a poorer job of serving the elderly and disabled than Medicare does. I have to add just one point. Stuart wants Bill Gates to have more skin in the game. I don't know how much Bill Gates makes. Let's assume he makes just $5 million a year. If he does so, he is paying $145,000 a year in payroll taxes for Medicare Part A, and when he reaches age 65, he will pay a premium equal to 80% of the value of Medicare Part B. How much skin in the game do you really want, Stuart?
100%.
He's got more than 100% already.
Thank you, Henry. Last but not least, Doug Holtz-Aiken.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for your patience. It's not easy going last, so let me be brief. Jim and Stuart are right. Judy, Paul, and Henry are, like my children, lovable but misguided. I think it's important to recognize that it is a welcome thing for us to have a return to a tradition of bipartisanship, which is about reforming Medicare to be sustainable for the future and to be the safety net program we need, and a departure from the more recent bipartisan tradition of attacking anyone who proposes to change the status quo in Medicare, because that tradition leads us down a very dangerous path. The status quo in Medicare is simply unsustainable, dangerous to beneficiaries, dangerous to the federal budget, and dangerous to the economy. We know that at the moment, the gap between Medicare premiums and payroll taxes paid in and spending going out is $280 billion. 10,000 new seniors are going to retire every day. And that program simply is unsustainable. It is a disservice to attack anyone who recognizes that this crucial piece of the safety net has to be made solvent over the long run. And that's been the attrition on both sides in recent years. We simply have to get away with that. I applaud Alice and Senator Domenici for leading this charge. I'm delighted to see Congressman Ryan and Senator Wyden stand up and talk about these reasonable changes for the future yesterday. And I was disappointed to see the White House immediately dismiss it. This is something we simply cannot, in good conscience, tolerate as a public. We have to make some changes for the future. Now, what would this do? I want to echo some of the comments that have been made before me. Part of the problem with the status quo is that it embodies a fundamental contradiction. It says to American beneficiaries, you may have all of the finest medical science America can invent at low or no cost. And that turns out to be very expensive, $280 billion cost overrun right now. And so the Congress has to try and say, stop that. And they either literally say stop that by cutting something off, or they cut reimbursements to the point where providers stop seeing Medicare beneficiaries. That's not a solution. We've seen that in Medicaid, a program that does not serve its population well at all. Moreover, the beneficiaries recognize this right away, and they revolt. They say, wait, that wasn't the promise. You said I could have all I wanted. Until we actually break that contradiction, until we say to the beneficiary and the provider community, these are the monies that you have. Here's the budget. Go provide a sensible set of services in an efficient way. We will never solve that problem, and the program will break under its own weight. So I'm with Stuart. I think one of the most important things that must be done is to put a budget on Medicare, and a premium support program is a way to put that budget in place. Now, there are others, and you'll notice that in Domenici Rivlin and in Wyden Ryan, there's also an overall backstop which puts the budget constraint in at an aggregate level. And those two competing visions of how to put the budget on, I think, are ones that we have to play out, and the competition is an important one. I personally favor the one that puts the money in the hands of the beneficiary, because we have seen so many times in America this debate over who gets to make tough health decisions. And what the American public has decided is it's not going to be an insurance company, and it's sure not going to be a government bureaucrat. And so in the end, it's going to have to be the American family that makes those tough care decisions, and you ought to put the money in the place where the decision is being made. And so I'd like to see a budget constraint. Premium support provides that. It also aligns the incentives with the ethical norms that Americans believe. And I think that's something that we will inevitably end up at, and we ought to just simply move the program that way from the beginning. Second thing about the status quo that is, I think, quite clear is that it drives bad medicine. I want to echo what Jim Capretta said. Look at the Medicare program. It's got these payment silos, Part A for hospitals, Part B for doctors, Part C for some insurance companies, Part D for the drug companies. There isn't a beneficiary to be found in there anywhere. It's a fragmented, uncoordinated system that drives bad medicine in America, and we can't afford bad medicine. It's too expensive. We need to have a delivery system reform that gets us toward more coordinated care and ones that anticipate the kinds of diseases that we have late in life with preventive care earlier on. This is a route to that, and I think it's very, very, very important that we pursue it. I also want to just take the liberty of pointing out that all of the concern about the risk associated with this are exactly the concerns that I heard as director of the CBO when the Medicare Part D program was enacted in 2003. That program is very much like the premium support programs that we are talking about today. It had the same concerns about too many choices, at one extreme, at the other extreme. Private plans would never enter and provide this. Neither of those concerns turned out to be true. Had the same concerns about how do you do reinsurance and avoid adverse selections. None of that turned out to be a problem. Had concerns about the cost of the program. It has come in under cost. The competitive program in Part D is the single best entitlement program we have. We should be modeling all our entitlement programs on successes, not on something else. And the Part D program is the shining success in our entitlement programs. And I think we ought to move more toward that at every opportunity. And this is a chance to do that. So I think the last thing I'll say, and then we can just close and get to the audience, is that something that has not been discussed yet, and a feature that I find interesting in what Wyden and Ryan rolled out yesterday, is the notion that you could allow employees in small firms to opt into this premium support program before the official Medicare eligibility age. I think that's an essential piece of the policy development that we have to address. There's been a lot of talk about portability in insurance, from job to job, job to home. It's an important discussion. But the most important missing portability right now is from early retirement age, 62, to Medicare eligibility. And they have taken a small step toward actually filling that need. It also aligns the incentives much better. If you as an insurer know that you have this person, perhaps a 45-year-old, and you may have them until they're 85, your decisions about what is an appropriate set of things to cover in terms of prevention and early interventions is completely different than the annual model on which most of insurance is modeled. So I think these are all very sensible designs. It's important to have this program survive to the next generation, and this is a way to do it in a rational, ethically sound, and efficient fashion.
Thank you. I have lots of questions myself, but I think I want to get the audience in now because we are running out of time. So take a couple of questions from the audience. Please introduce yourself and make your question brief. Let's start right here.
Medicare is a major problem
in
terms of cost. David Raven, Georgetown University. However, the healthcare cost issue is a national problem, not just a Medicare problem. We've heard historically Medicare costs less per capita than private insurance. It has the market power to change the healthcare system. We've also heard with agreement the healthcare system should be changed. I can't quite understand why we don't take relative certainty, a program that currently is more effective in containing costs, and accept instead an increased risk of having more people under private insurance. It seems to me that if we're concerned about the government problem, concerned about the national problem, we should be talking about a Medicare, an improved Medicare, a more cost-contained Medicare for the entire population. And I'd wonder why that wouldn't be your recommendations.
Thank you. Rather than everybody trying to respond, because we really are short on time, let's just take a couple more questions, get them all on the table here, and then we'll give a couple of you a shot at answering them. Yes, back there in the red sweater.
Hi, I'm Dr. Caroline Poplin, a primary care physician. My question is for Mr. Holtz-Aiken. You're assuming that every consumer will be faced with the same choice. But in fact, 20% of the Medicare population is responsible for something like 80% of the cost. Disease is chronic now. So a healthy person can pick a high deductible, high copay plan, and that will be fine. A person with chronic illness, that plan won't work at all. They're going to have to choose a different kind of plan that has first stop, because they're going to have to pay all the copays and deductibles. What do you do about the fact that patients will separate themselves out into people who are sick and people who are healthy?
Okay. I'm not seeing any more strong hands, and given I saw somebody timidly trying to get in over here. Okay, well, one more. Yes, you.
Hi, Lee Goldberg. Lee Goldberg with the National Academy of Social Insurance. It seems like there's sort of two discussions going on here. One is a disparagement of fee-for-service and the lack of coordination and the fragmentation of the healthcare system, which admittedly is a problem. And then a question about private plans versus a public program. And in the current program, current public Medicare program, you can be in a private HMO or you can be in a fee-for-service. If you are presumably in a premium support system, you still have the same set of choices. And there's no guarantee that people are going to be in a more integrated, coordinated plan. So it seems like there ought to be a more honest discussion of, in fact, what people want to do here is force people into more coordinated plans, and maybe that's a good thing, but that's sort of a different national discussion.
Interesting comment. Okay, I don't think, well, if you're very short, you may have one last comment here in response to these questions or anything else you've heard. Starting with Judy, we'll just go down the line quickly, but please, 30 seconds.
All right, David, I clearly agree with you. Carolyn, I agree with you, too. And Lee, I agree with you, too, in the question. But to pick up on Lee's question.
My gosh, you packed the audience.
No, that's you picked them. But Lee raises what I think is a very important question. There's been, I think, a discussion in terms of advocacy of premium support as a correction for fee-for-service that acts as if the Affordable Care Act never happened and doesn't accept the change in the facts that Henry alluded to. The fact is that everybody agrees we need to change the delivery system and to make it more coordinated and more integrated. Private insurers don't do that. Medicare, which actually Jim acknowledges has market power, is now charged with moving in that direction. And that's the direction, using Medicare and in connection and leading the whole healthcare system to improve it, that we ought to go.
Final comment, Jim.
Well, there's so much to say about some of these questions, but first of all, on the issue of whether Medicare is a better performer on costs than private plans, actually, if you look at the MedPAC data and look at HMOs that are participating in Medicare Advantage, they actually deliver the same Medicare package of benefits at less cost than Medicare fee-for-service. So it's not true. So and then you have to ask the question, well, if there's such a concern, why is there such concern about premium support and Medicare losing enrollment out of the traditional program into the private plans if the private plans are so inefficient and can't have low premiums? In other words, I've always wondered if fee-for-service is an option and it's competing on a level playing field with the private plans and it's the low-cost provider, what's the concern? Wouldn't most people stay in the low-cost provider? I think the reason there's a concern is because they know that in many, many parts of the country, fee-for-service is not the low-cost provider. It's very much the high-cost provider, and there'd be massive migration out of it. So there's lots of regional differences, but HMOs, on average, even with Medicare fee-for-service's tremendous advantages, which is it can dictate prices, I wouldn't necessarily call that market power, the HMOs actually would probably come in less. That's been verified by the actuary at Medicare number and numerous times, and he'll do it again if asked.
Doug.
So there is a clear divide that you're now seeing, and Judy's vision of the future is one in which the Medicare program gets improved by all of the bells and whistles in the Affordable Care Act. I think Henry would concur, and I'm skeptical of that. I think the road to healthcare hell is paved with demos, and those will never turn into on-the-ground changes that deliver the care in the fashion that we all know it needs to be. That's been the history of the program. But neither I nor anyone on this panel should decide. So instead, what you see is these proposals, Ryan and Wyden, Domenici, Rivlin, allow for the decision to be made by the American people. Put the best fee-for-service with all the bells and whistles out of the Innovation Center over here, put the premium support here, see which performs, and let the American people pick. It's a very sensible approach. And as for all the concerns you raised, those are all concerns that have been raised in Part D. All the selection issues, some people are sicker than others, works fine. And this can work too.
Paul.
There's been a major piece of this discussion which has been missing this morning. Doug Holtz-Eakin almost got there, but not quite. And that missing piece of the discussion is revenues. When the Rivlin-Domenici Task Force made its proposal for premium support, it was part of a comprehensive budget plan which had a reasonable balance between spending reductions and tax increases. That proposal had many attractive and sensible elements. In contrast, a lot of the proposals that we're seeing today for premium support, particularly those emanating from Congressman Ryan and, in fact, from most of my pro-premium support colleagues here on this dais, are in the context of budget plans which would rely primarily, if not exclusively, on benefit cuts, which would hit some of the most vulnerable people, including Medicare beneficiaries, and are extremely short on tax increases, if any. And I think we have to keep that in mind, that we have to look at the whole picture, and in considering the financial status of Medicare into the future, in the face of the large increase in the number of people, the capitas that Judy talked about at the beginning, we need to have a revenue component as well as changes in benefit structure.
Stuart?
If I can just pick up on the last question, first of all, it's correct. There is a subtext of this whole conversation about fee-for-service and coordinated care. I think if this was a medical conference and we were all physicians talking about this, I think there would be a general consensus that, medically speaking, it actually is better to coordinate somebody's care than to have them wandering all around the health system, you know, picking their best shot with the yellow pages. I think also to take Henry's paradigm of the onset Alzheimer's person, I think it's kind of easier to decide to enroll for Kaiser as opposed to some other coordinated plan than to figure out which primary care physician to go to and to look at their prospectus and which hospital and so on. So I think that is part of it. I think with regard to the premium support approach, it is a question of saying keep this debate or this conversation, make the system neutral as to which way you go and let other things determine that. That's why a premium support system should neither foster nor should it act against the fee-for-service system. And I think that's a crucial element in what you see in Rivlin Domenici and in the Wyden-Ryden plan.
As an economist, my union card says I have to like competition, and I do. That's one of the reasons I think the current Medicare system isn't so bad in that dimension. There is the potential for all the competition you could possibly want, since private plans, particularly, incidentally, Jim, in high-cost areas, because of the way payments are set, could organize themselves and offer a product that people want to buy. Now, so far, private plans have done that for a little over 25% about 25% of Medicare enrollees. They've done that with the aid of about a 15% subsidy over the cost of fee-for-service medicine, but it isn't clear whether they would have attracted so many people without that subsidy. But competition exists. It's not something that premium support would create. If you like competition, we got it. Furthermore, I have no brief for the fee-for-service system or for disorganized, fragmented medical care. The question is, how do we get from here to the improved delivery system on which I think all seven of us here emphatically agree? There is absolutely no reason to believe that private insurance plans have any particular interest in moving us in that direction. They have not been particularly effective in doing so, apart from the flagship health maintenance organizations and Intermountain Health and Geisinger that get trotted out all the time and that do provide high-quality, comparatively low-cost care. They're great. They haven't, if you will, metastasized through the system, unfortunately. The real discussion here, and let me conclude, the real discussion here is who bears the cost from bad surprises if healthcare costs rise more than we think they will. Under Medicare, they are diffused broadly through the system as a whole. Under premium support, they would be disproportionately imposed on the elderly and the disabled. That is, in my view, what the central issue that this debate is really all about. And the division between the two sides on this boils down, I believe, to that point. Finally, if any of you would like copies of Judy's, Paul's, and my comments, we have them in writing and would be glad to give them to you.
I think it's been a terrific discussion. Please join me in thanking all of these wonderful people.